Welcome to Race and Democracy, a podcast on the intersection between race, democracy, public policy, social justice, and citizenship. Well, today's guest is my friend, the Princeton anthropologist, Lawrence Ralph, who is a professor of anthropology at Princeton University, where he is the director for the Center on Transnational Policing. Before that, he was a tenured professor at Harvard University. He is the author of Renegade Dreams and The Torture Letters. He has been a Guggenheim Fellow, a fellow of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, a member of the Institute for Advanced Study, and an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He lives in Princeton, New Jersey with his wife and two children. And we are going to be talking about his brand new book, Sito, An American Teenager and the City That Failed Him. Lawrence Ralph, welcome to Race and Democracy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, I've known you for a long time, big admirer and fan of your work. You know, I thought that this book was incredibly moving. And you do so much in this book, but it's also very, very personal, this book, in terms of the story. So can you tell us about Luis Alberto Quiñones, known as Sito, and your relationship with him or to him?
Yeah, so Luis, or Sito, as we call him, was my stepson's younger brother. I didn't have a very close relationship to him while he was living. I learned a lot more about his life after his death. He died at 19 years old as a result of murder. And there were two remarkable things about Sito's life that I wanted to highlight. One was that he was falsely accused of a murder when he was 14 years old, and that murder allegation would really transform his life and haunt him in many ways. And the other was that he himself was murdered. And so I wanted to think about the possibility of really starting over, starting a new life, and how can that happen when there are all kinds of pitfalls built into the criminal justice system itself, the main one being vengeance. And I really wanted to tackle that question of vengeance that's embedded in the law through this book.
Now, this book is set in San Francisco. This is where Sito was living. Can we talk about those systems that you're talking about? Because one of the things I found interesting was that Sito, his father, Rene, but the run-ins with the law. I mean, he was arrested as early as 12 for stealing an iPhone, an arrest that was later expunged, but he was honest about the arrest. When he becomes his journey to becoming a community activist and an abolitionist. So, and you talk about the sociologist Victor Rios, who talks about the criminalization of young people and how sort of school becomes, instead of this pathway towards success, young people in certain zip codes, school becomes the institution that criminalizes them. Can you talk about San Francisco? And you really, what I found fascinating, you deal with young Latino and Black, but Latino men here, boys, and you talk about the disproportionality of them getting arrested and them being marginalized, which is very, very interesting for me. And even reading the San Francisco setting, I thought was really, really interesting, because you don't think of San Francisco as this place that is very harsh. And you talk about the gentrification of the Mission. So it's really such a rich and richly textured story. So I want you to talk about, you know, the subtitle of the book is The City That Failed Him, you know, and I think at the start of the book, you know, after hearing the news, you and your wife is also an anthropologist, and there's a point where you're meeting the family and you're trying to help advocate, but you're also thinking about healing and restorative justice. And it's quite the journey that you go on as well. So this idea of the city that failed him, how did San Francisco sort of treat Sito?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, San Francisco is a fascinating city from an outsider's perspective. And I had never really spent a lot of time there for a long amount of time. I think writing this book, I was there for a year living in the city. But before that, I had only visited. And I think that it's easy to get these different aspects of the city. You know, you could see there's a freshness to it. There's a kind of Silicon Valley feel to it. But then there's the murals everywhere. There's this life beyond what you see at the present moment, the glitz and glamour of the present moment. And I was always fascinated by that juxtaposition. And walking around the city with my wife, who had grown up in the Mission District as well, her noting to me what was there and what wasn't. You know, I think it's a similar story to many major American cities, but it's one that always strikes me in the moment. Just how you can see how two people can experience a city totally differently, and they can live in the same place, right? And I think for someone who just moved to the city, or someone who's kind of working at a Google startup or something, or a Google or a startup, they'll experience San Francisco totally different from someone like Sito, whose family's been there for generations, who are trying to hold on to a piece of the city, who are trying to even make a claim that the city is still theirs. There's a totally different way in which they experience the city and the city that treats them. I think the subtitle, The City That Failed Him, I'm mainly talking about the institutions within San Francisco. I'm talking about schools. I'm talking about the juvenile justice system and the criminal justice system within the city. I'm talking about the activist networks within the city. I'm talking about, you know, healthcare in the city, the hospitals in the city. And so I think what's remarkable about Sito's story is that in a lot of instances, this institutions that could have been there for him to support him, to help him thrive, actually disappointed him, let him down. And he felt that disappointment. And that disappointment was partially responsible for how his story turned out. You know, a key example is, I guess, the criminal justice system, of course, where he was falsely accused of murder at 14 years old.
And let's talk about that, because you have a great gripping description of that. What exactly happens? Like, was Sito, I think some readers would think, was Sito part of a gang? Was certainly you talk about gangs and histories of gangs, including the Latin mafia and all these different folks, gangs that are coming out of prisons, gangs that are coming out of deprivation. So what are the circumstances that led up to Sito being falsely accused of murder?
Yeah. So I think this is one of the things that it's hardest to explain, because I think the circumstances that led up to Sito's false arrest could have easily not happened. You know, like, had he been there 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later, his life could have been totally different. And I think that is actually the reality of a lot of youth living in cities like San Francisco or Chicago, where your life could change, you know, at the drop of a dime. So what happened with Sito was that he was, you know, walking his neighborhood with a young man who was an acquaintance of his that he didn't know well, but he knew. And both of them were loosely affiliated to the gangs in the area, and in that their families had been involved. They traded on that respect at certain times, yet they weren't active gang members. In this moment, they were walking the neighborhood and they encountered a young man who Sito had problems with in school, in his previous middle school the year before. They got into an argument. The young man who Sito was with lunged at the boy Sito was yelling at. He stabbed him, and both groups went off running in different directions. The young man who was stabbed was with his younger brother at the time, right? And so I think about this a lot because of how contingent it is, right? First of all, in a argument like that, it didn't have to get to a fight. In a fight, it didn't have to get to a stabbing.
I was surprised at stabbing, because usually stabbings happen actually in England more than they do here, right? Especially London, right? So more than the United States. So it was interesting it was tragic. But.
And in a stabbing, it didn't have to result in death. That was the tragic part of it. So it was a perfect storm of tragedy that allowed this incident to happen.
And when we think about that incident, Sito is then going to have his first extended stay in jail. And so how many months does he end up spending before he's exonerated? And so, yeah, first, how many months? And then I want to talk about what is the impact on him of spending that time?
So he spends 5 months in the juvenile detention center.
And one thing, we should describe Sito. How is Sito physically?
At this moment, he's 14 years old.
But was he a big 14-year-old, small 14-year-old?
He was a probably small 14 years old. And that's key because the youngest you can be in juvenile detention is 14. So he's there. He's one of the youngest there, one of the smallest there. He's there with people who are up to 19.
I was very frightened for him reading this.
Right. And so it was a transformative time for him, right? And the thing about jail or something like juvenile hall is that you're there kind of waiting for your trial date or waiting for your sentencing, and that can extend the time. Sociologist Michael Walker talks about this in a book he wrote called Indefinite, where we often in the public imagination conflate prison and jails. But actually jail has a different temporality, because you go to jail as soon as you're arrested, and usually you're going to jail or you're awaiting trial. And if you're convicted, you go to prison. But the thing about that is that if you know you didn't do something, every day you're thinking, this is the day I'm going to get out. This is the day they're going to find the evidence that I didn't do it and I'm going to be released. And so the time feels different. The time gets extended, right? And so if you're a young person, one of the youngest in there, you know you didn't do it, and every day is like a waiting game to see, is this the day I'm going to be released, or is this the day that I'm going to have to accept my fate? Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of wear and tear that the juvenile hall had on Sito.
And so you talk about, let's further explore that. This, you talk about PTSD and young people throughout here, and you cite data. But in a lot of ways, we don't think about people who've been arrested, especially juvenile incarceration, as experiencing a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder afterwards. Because Sito gets out, but what we see, And I'd love to explore this deeper with you. I mean, he's going to have struggles, his own struggles with alcohol. He's going to have struggles at times with anger. You know, when we think about that time from 14 to 19, it seems like he's finding his identity in the context of abolitionism. And he joins this organization. The acronym spells courage, and you can let us know what that means. But talk to us about when you think about Sito, it seems like the time in jail both served as an inspiration eventually, but also had really negative impacts where he seems anxiety riddled for the rest of his life in terms of how I read Sito.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think on a basic level, part of that childhood is stolen, right? So I think he has to grow up really fast within that juvenile hall. Physically, his body changes just in that 5 months from being arrested to getting out. But there are things that happen in which he feels that the police are sitting on evidence when they know they could release him. They have the video that he didn't do it, yet he's still incarcerated. So there's just this distrust, right? And so at least three things are happening that fundamentally is changing his outlook on life. One is that he saw someone get killed. He saw someone get stabbed. He may not have known in that moment that it resulted in death, but he is struggling to live with the fact that he saw someone get killed, someone he knew, a young person.
Even though he had disagreements with him, And he has an outburst on that date. The death date is September 2nd, right?
Yeah. And then he knows anything can happen to you at any moment, right? Something bad can happen to you at any moment, right? And now he knows that you may not be exonerated or you may not, you know, experience what we think of as justice when something bad happens, right? And so a lot of his outbursts and a lot of his anxiety has to do with those three things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just the stress of knowing, am I safe here? Anything could happen to me.
People wanted revenge. And in fact, the boy who actually did kill Sito's acquaintance is later murdered himself.
Right.
You know, which is really remarkable. So there's this sort of, I mean, the book shows it very well, this kind of cycle of violence, even though these aren't gang members, although police treat them as gang members too. So you kind of see the disrespect, even though they might be like their parents were, or they're sort of gang adjacent. And like you said, they're trading off of that kind of respect. But in the ensuing 5 years, in certain ways, he does turn his life around. So talk to us about the positives that happen in that 5 years. He gets a girlfriend. He seems to have a very complicated relationship with his dad, Renee, his mom, Beatrice. But he seems like he's trying to turn around his dad's small business, which is about to close. And he says, no, I want to turn this into a nonprofit that's going to help in terms of prison reform. And he really becomes this abolitionist. It's not consistent or linear in that way, because there's one final arrest before his killing, his murder. So talk to us about the positives. And really, especially when he was at his most clear, not drinking, not upset, what kind of person was Sito?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was always a very intelligent person. And I think, like, throughout, that was probably the one thing that got him through. Mm-hmm. Even when he was struggling, he had a way of thinking about problems, approaching them in a different way. He was likable. He had a great personality. People gravitated towards him. He had charisma. So I think those things really helped him throughout. I think when he was kind of hitting his stride afterwards was when he kind of joined this activist organization in San Francisco called Courage. And the thing about that organization was that they gave him permission to use his experience as a resource and say, no, this is not just a tragic thing that happened to you, or this is not just a thing that a bad part of you that you need to cleanse and become somebody else, right? This is something that you learned from, you built skills out of. Now you can speak to other youth about your experiences and what it meant to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that was the most clear-eyed he was in thinking about, how do I prevent another youth from experiencing what I experienced? Mm-hmm. And that motivated him to want to shut down the juvenile hall that had incarcerated him. And that was part of Courage's mission.
And was he successful in doing that?
Yeah, they were successful in having a judgment that the juvenile hall would transform to less punitive approaches to incarcerating youth.
Okay. And now 2019, so you actually, and your wife, you received the call in the news. Now that you've written the book and you reconstruct the events, but even as you're reconstructing the events, you don't want to do it in an exploitive way, and you talk about that while reconstructing the events. What happens on his death day? And you know, you can tell us who actually is the perpetrator of the crime, and how does it connect to that 5 years previous, that stabbing of Sito's acquaintance?
Yeah, so that day of the stabbing, there were four people there. As I mentioned, there was Sito, there was a boy named Miguel who actually stabbed Rashawn Williams, and it was Rashawn's little brother. And the person who ended up killing Sito was Rashawn's little brother. And so, you know, again, part of the reason why I said I think about that all the time is because that event changed the trajectory of four people's lives, mm-hmm.
yeah,
in
forever.
A blink.
Yeah.
You know, so Miguel was killed a year later.
Mm-hmm.
Rashawn was killed not even 24 hours later. Sito was killed 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And Julius, the person who killed Sito, was incarcerated. So all of their lives dramatically mm-hmm. changed.
And three out of the four
are
dead.
Right.
It's really unbelievably, it's horrible.
Right. And so how do we unpack that, right? And so part of the book is just trying to unpack that event and saying that, no, it's not just senseless violence. Mm-hmm. There are reasons for all these things. Let's think through them, right? And let's take a close look at least one person's life and try to disentangle how this is possible.
Now, you, throughout the book, you do digressions into these different religious fables. And I wanted you to talk about that. The Orishis and the just all of it, like, and how did that help you in terms of the explanatory power of that, you know, sort of Vodun and
I mean, I thought of part of this book was really, as we mentioned in the beginning, really capturing the feel of San Francisco and the feel of a community. And one way I try to do that is through the murals that are there everywhere,
yes. mm-hmm.
that really speak to community mm-hmm. and activism and history, right? Another way I try to do that is through spirituality mm-hmm. and the spirituality that's prevalent in the community, but also for Sito's family.
Mm-hmm.
And through discussing spirituality, I'm trying to get at another register of justice
mm-hmm.
because it's pretty obvious that justice within the law is not going to be satisfactory for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's not satisfactory for Sito's family.
No.
It's not satisfactory for Rashawn's family. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, there's this doubt that the police or the courts will actually do anything for a long time. And there's a way in which, as you said, they just see all of these young men as gang members. And if they're not gang members now, they will be in the future. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to care about that.
No,
right?
I don't see any empathy from the police.
Right. And so I was looking for another way, another idea of justice. And this was the way that was speaking to me, because it was coming from Sito's family, and because it was coming from Sito in a way, because towards the end, he didn't believe in locking people up, right? And so what would it mean that, what would he have wanted for his killer even, you know? And this is a question that his family often asked themselves, like, what would Sito have wanted? Would he wanted his friends to retaliate? No, he wouldn't have wanted that. Would he wanted his killer even to spend the rest of his whole life in prison? No, he wouldn't have wanted that.
And what happens to his killer? Because I know the sentence is 83 years, but he's a juvenile, and you say he can only do 4. So what happened to his killer?
He did the maximum juvenile sentence, which is 4 years.
And he's out of jail now.
And this summer, he'll be out.
He'll be out. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, what do you think of that in terms of, as somebody who obviously believes in restorative justice? What do you think?
Yeah, man. I think we have to figure out a new way of accountability
mm-hmm.
that's not relying on punishment.
Mm-hmm.
But I think accountability still is key there.
This young man never admitted to doing
right,
it.
Right, right. So
never took responsibility.
Right. So how do we think of accountability in that case, right, where someone who doesn't... I think a lot of the way that we even think of restorative justice, transformative justice, presumes that people will be accountable, but just not in a punitive way.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have a lot of good answers for what if people don't want to be accountable to
and,
that.
And in the book, I wasn't sure if you were suggesting that he murders Sito when Sito is 19 and he's 17. Do you feel that Sito's murderer understood that as a juvenile he would receive a lesser sentence, or was that coincidental?
That's one theory that's out there, that he understood it because of the way that the murder took place. It was very premeditated, mm-hmm. very planned, orchestrated, and thought out. So the question is, if you're going to think about how to execute a murder to that extent, including like how to, you know, handle particular weapons, how to fire them and things like that, then it's not unreasonable to assume that you would think about when to do it, you know?
Which makes this an even more difficult case
right.
in terms of restorative justice, because, and you quote from Mariam Kaba at times, and a story that she tells about, you know, restorative justice and imagining a world where punishment isn't our MO. I mean, in the case of Sito, do you feel that he's gotten in his family, that they've received justice, or do they feel they've received justice? And this is different from saying, do they want more punishment
right.
for his killer?
Yeah,
right?
No, I don't think that they feel like they received justice. And that was part of the impetus of writing the book. But part of the receiving justice for them would be for people to know Sito's story. And for Sito's story to be known is that that he didn't kill Rashawn Williams, that he was never exonerated. That,
he didn't kill anybody.
Right. And so I think that aspect of it was the aspect of the story that's correcting the narrative was a form of justice for them, is a form of justice for them.
Well, I've got like three more questions. So one, what was the process? How did this impact you? Because I've read your previous work, and with Renegade Dreams, you embedded into Chicago and Chicago victims of gangland violence. It was the first book I've read where you really looked at people who were in wheelchairs, people who had colostomy bags, people who had, because we never think of like what happens after these predominantly young men, sometimes women, are killed. So it's really remarkable and revelatory. But with this is somebody who, is much closer to home. What was the process of writing this, and how did it impact you? Because I can see throughout the different deliberations that are happening to you, and you actually titled the last chapter or before the epilogue, Compassionate Rage. So what was this like? What was it like writing this, just as a scholar, as a writer, as somebody who's a thinker, but who's also interested in restorative justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely a sense of urgency in writing it. I think one aspect stemmed from the fact that, just most immediately, how do we try to end this cycle of violence, right? Mm-hmm. And so Sito's killer, he was 17 when he killed Sito, but he was 12 when his brother was murdered. So you can imagine for a 12-year-old, when you're coming of age, you're thinking about what it means to be a man, how much that murder must have shaped his identity, right? And so in a way, I'm thinking about how do I write it, not even for Sito's friends now, but for people who love Sito, who are even younger, who are going to come of age thinking about his death and form their identities based on stories they hear about his death. Mm-hmm. What would I want to tell them about it? And so part of it was just thinking about that. And that was urgent for me to kind of think about how to tell the stories, these intertwined stories, and how to try to break these cycles of violence.
And how has the family received the book? Because it was published last year.
I think there's no easy answer for that. I think it's one thing I learned about it is that people's relationship to the book changes. And so for some people, during the process when I was trying to write the book, they weren't on board. But when they saw how it came out and they saw that it was a kind of tribute to Sito's legacy, then they were more on board, right? For some people that they were with me with the process and then it came out, it's triggering, to see him memorialized in that way, right? Even to see the cover is triggering, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's been a spectrum, and it's changed throughout time, right? And
are mom and dad happy with it? I know Beatrice gave you the picture for the cover of the book, Sito, and she took the author photo.
And I think things like that were important for them just to feel like they were a part of it and to contribute in those ways, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I think for the most part, everybody understands like the choices that were made. You know, I think in any, you know, when you're an author writing a book, ultimately, you have to make the ultimate choice on like how, like what is the message. And for me, the message had to do more with like, how do we break this cycle of violence? How do we live up to Sito's legacy? And I think the main difficulty in writing the book is that everybody knew Sito how they knew him, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like, Sito's, you know, cousin doesn't know him the way that his girlfriend knows him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And his girlfriend doesn't know him the way that his brother
Absolutely.
Knows him.
They all have right? siloed versions of him, and right. you show a panoramic version.
Exactly. So in putting all of those stories together, sometimes those stories conflicted with the version of Sito they knew.
Mm-hmm.
But they were true to the version, the collective version that I was told, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And so I think that was and is the most difficult part in writing the book.
Well, my final question is really a larger question about Sito and the criminal justice system, mass incarceration, you know, Black Lives Matter, where we're at in 2025. Because in certain ways, reading this, and at the end of the book, you say how Chesa Boden, who was the former San Francisco DA, he's been voted out. And those were the DAs, like Philadelphia's DA, San Francisco's DAs, that were supposed to be the progressive DAs, the post-Ferguson DAs, who were interested in reform, interested in doing some kinds of reforms that didn't just lock people up. There's been at least reportedly increases in crime in San Francisco, quality of life crimes that made voters really push back against this specific DA. So we're really, really back to almost a 1990s law and order rhetoric nationally about crime, right? And even though we still have 2 million people incarcerated. So one, where do you think we're at when it comes to that? Because obviously you spent your life studying this and doing big projects connected to this. And how can Sito's story be impactful in that conversation? Because I see this as part of this larger, for me, I would call it historiography. Some people would call it literature, but I would say historiography on just incarceration, the carceral state, but connected to that, restorative justice, abolition, alternatives to that carceral state. And alternatives, I think in Sito, you show it in practice, but also alternatives discursively too, and institutionally. Politically, ideologically?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really worried about the, like, return to law and order. And I think that as a mistake. At the same time, I think that in a way, we anchor that law and order debate when we don't ask the hardest questions, right?
Yeah.
And so in Sito, I'm trying to ask the hardest questions, right? I think often in the literature and abolition, we skate over some of the hardest questions. Like when people ask, oh, what about murder though? Or what about youth, a young person that murdered? Like we say, oh, well, statistically, that's not really, you know, which is true, but there's such an emotional impact on those cases that they're outsized, right?
Yes.
And so I'm trying to grapple with the hardest case that I know and say, even through this hardest case, we can find some grace in the way that we treat it institutionally, societally, interpersonally. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to feel rage, you know? It just means that we have to temper that rage with compassion somehow, because that's what families are doing all of the time, right? And so that's what I'm trying to achieve with this book. I do think it is part of that historiography, but it's part of the what is behind the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we see, you know, 36 murdered in Chicago this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
What do we actually know about those 36 people?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we see that, oh, there's a 5% uptick in crime in San Francisco, what do we really know about that 5%, right? And so this is telling the story of that, of those people, and really trying to get beyond what we think we know into a place where we can actually defend our stances, and we can actually say, no, we have thought about violent crime, and we're grappling with ways to deal with it. Communities are grappling with ways to deal with it, and they don't just want more punishment. All right.
All right. We'll end on that grace note. I think you do this really beautifully. My guest today is Lawrence Ralph, and the book is Cito, An American Teenager in the City That Failed Him. It reminded me reading it of Bryan Stevenson's book, Just Mercy, a book that I really, really love and teach. Lawrence Ralph is professor of anthropology at Princeton University, where he's the director for the Center of Transnational Policing. He's the author of Renegade Dreams and the Torture Letters and Cito, an award-winning scholar, and an elected member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
Always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode. And you can check out related content on Twitter at Peniel Joseph. That's PENIELJOSEPH. And our website, csrd.lbj.utexas.edu. And the Center for Study of Race and Democracy is on Facebook as well. This podcast was recorded at the Liberal Arts Development Studio at the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you.